That's from 1983, Serious Business, John Mellencamp giving us his variation on tonight's theme. The book we're talking about, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, by Zoe Cormier, looks at the science of hedonism and the hedonism of science. We're smack dab in the middle of a conversation about the drug part of this. For a lot of people, we probably all know people who did acid, and for whom there are at least some of those folks who kind of got burned out as a result. But for others, there are folks who not only said it didn't harm them, but it actually did them some good. Going to jump into that part of the conversation, and we'll be opening up the phone lines a little bit later so you can join into the chat. So stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast. Before the break, Zoe, we were talking about LSD. As a way to reset this conversation, can you bring us to share the story with the audience about how LSD was developed, what this guy was looking for when he sort of came upon this discovery?
Hoffman? It's a very good question because it's very timely. So acid was born on April 19th, 1943. And it was an accidental byproduct of Albert Hoffman's quest to produce medications to prevent death by postpartum hemorrhaging. So he was trying to make drugs that would stop women from dying in childbirth. And he got a little bit on his fingers on April 19th, 1943. And as he rode his bicycle home, he started to trip. And he had the world's very first acid trip. It was very gentle. And then he decided that he wanted to understand what had happened to him, because he was not a hippie. He was a Swiss nerd. He was the biggest nerd who ever nerded a nerd. He was a math nerd, and he'd never even smoked pot. And so having taken a substance that then distorted his vision and altered his experience of the world was very, very befuddling and very confusing. So he decided on a quote-unquote self-experiment, and he gave it to himself in a very high dose, about 250 micrograms, and he did this, and I'm not messing with you, he did this at 4:20 p.m., one of the best coincidences in drug history.
Yeah. I see. You said something in the book. I thought it was really, I had never heard this before, and I hope I'm remembering it correctly, but I think you said that he continued to take it through the rest of his life to a ripe old age?
Yeah. He took it until he was 96, and he lived to be 102.
What was he worried about, getting burned out at the age of 96? Or so he just stopped, or what? I wonder what was going on there.
I don't know. I never met him, but other people that I've spoken to who have met him said that he was a very healthy, very cheerful, very calm, very happy human being.
You know, we've all read about the pitfalls of LSD and people thinking it can fly and jumping off buildings. And I'm more serious. I know that there have been incidents like that, though they're probably blown out of proportion. The idea that somebody can take too much of this stuff and it causing brain damage, that's a more serious matter. How much evidence is of how widespread that is?
Very little.
On the flip side, you have some pretty good examples of people who say that it benefited them. Steve Jobs, right?
Yeah, Steve Jobs said that it was one of the, quote, one or two most important things that I've done in my entire life, which is very surprising because Apple's designs are not very psychedelic, but I suspect he may have been saying that more in a marketing move than a profession of his true experience, but it is what he said.
And then there was an example of a Nobel Prize winner who had, I think it was LSD that he took, or was it DMT?
It was LSD, and that's Terry Mullis that you're thinking of.
Right.
So Terry Mullis got his insight into the structure of DNA and how to read it on acid. And he was driving at the time, which is amazing because that's what Ken Kesey did with the Merry Pranksters, driving around America, taking lots of acid and speed and more acid and lots of acid. And Terry Miller said that he was on acid and he was driving and, quote, DNA chains coiled and floated, lurid blue and pink images of electric molecules injected themselves somewhere between the mountain road and my eyes. And that's how he came up with the, what's called the polymerase chain reaction, which is a scientific method basically for reading the language of DNA. And it really was a stroke of genius. It changed the face of genetics for the rest of time. And he got this idea on acid.
You shared with us an experience in the book. I don't think it was acid. I think it was DMT or something like that, that you took it as a medical necessity. Tell us that story and how it affected you.
Are you talking about lamotrigine or DMT?
Yeah.
Because one was recreational, one was a medical necessity.
One was the medical necessity is the one I'm talking about.
Lamotrigine. Yeah. Okay. So I have temporal lobe epilepsy. And in my mid-20s, I experienced a resurgence in my seizures. And it was kind of unpleasant. So I spent about a year and a half getting MRIs and EEGs. And my essential question was, you know, why have my seizures come back? Do I have a brain tumor? Is there something that's going to kill me inside my head? And the MRI showed no. They showed that I have what's called jagged brain waves. And when the neuroscientist showed me the paperwork, and he said, your brain waves are jagged, I said, no, I speak biology. You can be more precise than that. You can use terminology. He said, no, jagged, that's the technical term. So it actually says jagged brainwaves on my medical paperwork, which I suppose is kind of rock and roll, really, when you think about it. So they then said, take these pills. And I said, I don't want to. I just wanted the diagnosis. I just wanted to know that I don't have cancer or anything. Like, I don't want to take any medication. And she said, well, I'm the expert, and you come to me for my advice, and my advice is that you take this. And if I can probably count on one hand, you know, on five fingers, the number of things in my life that I regret. And I don't regret anything more than taking that prescription. After 8 months being on this thing, I was sleeping 18 hours a day. I put on about 40 pounds in weight. I had constant nightmares. It made me unbelievably tired in a way that I've never felt before or since, and it destroyed my liver. And I think it's, you know, kind of profound that the worst drug I've ever taken was a legal one.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. You know, the casualties from legal drugs, I mean, illegal drugs cause terrible carnage. I mean, heroin and cocaine, there's been terrible abuse. But all of that carnage matched against what's legal drugs is nothing. It's a drop in the bucket. You think about the alcohol industry and how, you note in the book, it's painted itself as not really producing a drug when it, in fact it is. Big pharma, legal pharmaceuticals, prescribed medicine kills so many more people than the illegal stuff. And yet if somebody wants to research things like psilocybin, which has shown great promise in many ways, or LSD, a scientist who wanted to get into that faces incredible obstacles. I'm sure that the big alcohol, big pharma, and the drug cartels are all in agreement. They're all in agreement this stuff should be kept illegal, which makes it very hard for anybody to research positive aspects of it. Right?
That is an issue that people talk about, whether or not Big Pharma has a role to play in prohibiting research on things like psilocybin and LSD. I don't know if that's indeed the case, but what is true is that they won't profit off them in the same way they would, say, Xanax or Prozac, because LSD was made in 1940s. In fact, it was made in 1939. psilocybin is a naturally occurring chemical. MDMA was made in 1912. So they're not patentable. So that means that you won't profit off them the same way you would a brand new molecule. And that is definitely, I wouldn't say that it impedes people doing research on the molecules, but it impedes funding for that.
Yeah, well, you make the point in the book at some point, if you wanted to get, I forget what the amount is, an ounce of a particular substance or something, it would be 5,000 pounds to buy an ounce of something that would cost $20 on the street.
So yeah, it was 5,000 pounds for a gram of MDMA, a gram, not a pound, a gram, for a gram of MDMA, 17,000 pounds for a gram of liquid psilocybin. It makes scientific study impossible.
Well, that was sort of the point I was making there, that by making it illegal, it makes it tough for scientists to explore the benefits of some of this stuff.
Yeah, it's one of the biggest missed opportunities in medicine, I would say.
Let's switch for a second to rock and roll here, because I'm going to be opening up the phone lines at the bottom of the hour. Why are drugs and rock so intertwined? I mean, is it sort of, in a way, pressing the same button in the human brain somehow, those two?
That's a very good question. And I would say, first of all, they're not necessarily entwined. You can enjoy one without the other very easily. But the scientists at McGill in Montreal, they did find in 2005 that music results in the release of dopamine from an area of the brain called the nucleus accumbens. And the exact same chemical reaction happens when you have sex and when you take cocaine. When you listen to music, it produces the exact same chemical. It touches the exact same button. So, yes, in a way, music is a drug.
I know the connection to sex and rock and roll, I mean, is pretty obvious. We were, from the beginning, you know, parents, when they were horrified by rock and roll, they called it the devil's music, and it, they were worried it was going to lead to premarital sex, and it sure did. It did do a lot. I mean, that link seems to be real.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, the link is obviously real. Whether or not it's chemically determined is another question.
You think about all the rock and roll casualties to drugs, and maybe you can make the argument, you don't, that it inspires creativity or opens up minds of people and changes them for the good, but it's also taken a terrible toll. You think about the long laundry list of names, Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and Jim Morrison, and the near misses. I mean, Ringo Starr was inducted in the Hall of Fame last night, and he had a period where he was in bad shape. He changed his tune, got straight. There is an undeniable toll that rock is that has been taken inside rock and roll by drugs in excess, right?
Absolutely, and I think that we have to acknowledge that we kind of encourage it. A very instructive example, I think, is Amy Winehouse. So when she died, it was a Saturday night, and I was at the Secret Garden party at a music festival in England, and no one knew for sure if she was dead or not, because we were in a field with thousands of people, and no one's phone was working because, you know, you're in a wet, soggy field in England, and the internet was bad, and people thought, oh, is it a rumor that's being spread so that she's playing a secret gig on the main stage? So for about 2 hours, no one was really sure if she was dead or not. And then when people finally realized that, in fact, she was actually dead, it wasn't some sort of viral rumor being spread, you couldn't find a sound system anywhere that wasn't playing the song Rehab. And there was kind of a macabre tone to it. It was like the entire generation was saying, ah, we have a legend of our own.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of musicians.
It was celebratory, Ari.
I'm sorry?
The air to it was celebratory. It was kind of sad.
So many musicians, they get the idea that drugs are their muse, that they have to be loaded to be creative. And then they find out later,
Yeah.
once they straighten up, that they can actually be more productive when they're not loaded.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about
Yeah,
that at all?
Stephen King. No, Stephen King wrote, which was shocking. I had no idea. Stephen King has a book called On Writing, and I had no idea that he was an absolute cokehead and booze hound for years. And he had an intervention where his children poured a pile of blood-splattered Coke spoons in front of him. And, he sort of woke up that was the reason to change. And he wrote that, I believe it's, quote, "The idea that creative endeavors and intellectual meaning are entwined with substance abuse is one of the greatest myths of popular culture."
Yeah, but he, I guess,
Yes.
I would agree with him. But undeniably, he had some pretty productive years there while he was doing those drugs. When you think about it, he cranked out a lot of books. The guy was writing a book a month, it seemed
Yeah.
like, for some time. I guess it's because he didn't
Yeah.
sleep. Do you what is your take then? Do you think they should be, those kind of drugs, LSD, cocaine, marijuana, should be illegal? Should be controlled substances after you've done all this research? And how do you think most scientists look at it?
I would say that they shouldn't be illegal because prohibition never works. However, they shouldn't necessarily be encouraged. It's a very, very, very difficult question to answer. As I was saying earlier, prohibition, we know it doesn't work. The war on drugs has not worked. The war on booze, the war on cocaine, the war on marijuana, none of it worked. If you tell people not to do something, either you encourage A, the development of stronger drugs, such as something called crocodile, which is what they're doing in Russia. It's like what heroin is to morphine, crocodile is to heroin. It's very strong and very destructive. And if you want to see images you can't unsee, Google image crocodile, starts with a K. In Brazil, they have something called Peco. And I've seen a few people who, a few homeless people on this, and it's absolutely devastating. It's so sad to see people completely emaciated. And that is a result of the war on drugs, because when you make the cheap stuff difficult to acquire, you encourage development of stronger stuff that's more concentrated. What you really need to do is to give people. It's like you were saying earlier, people get into drugs when they're in prison, right? If people
Yes.
have a good quality of life, they're not necessarily inclined to chemical self-obliteration.
Well, that's right. There's an experiment or a case study in the book. I can't remember where the location is, where the
Rat
point is
Park.
proven. Yeah. Tell that story.
Rat Park. Yeah. Yeah, so his name is Bruce Alexander, and he was a psychologist at Simon Fraser in Vancouver. And he thought, well, most of the studies that were done on rats being given cocaine were in standard laboratory settings where the rats were in cages and they were given little buttons where they could inject cocaine directly into their spines. So imagine that you're a rat and you've got a piece of glassware inserted into your spinal cord, right? And you're in a cage and you can't move and you can't play and there are no females to have sex with. What are you going to do? Well, if you've got a button that gives you drugs, you're going to do it. And that is very similar to what people have in prison. Very little social contact that's meaningful, stuck in a cage, very unhappy.
Zoe, I'm
So
sorry to
Bruce
interrupt you, but
Alexander thought.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. The music is telling us it's time for a break. My fault for asking that question when you didn't have enough time, but we'll pick it up on the other side, and we'll open up the phone lines with some questions for our listeners. We're talking with Zoe about her book, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. Neil Young takes us into the break. When this song came out, the No-No song, it was a quirky hit, 1974, for Ringo Starr. And although the song says no, 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 at the time in his life, Ringo Starr was saying yes, yes, yes. Eventually, he said he got tired of waking up feeling bad and not knowing what had been done for days. So he got into rehab, turned his life around, and is still going strong, and now in his 70s. And as I mentioned yesterday, had been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Congratulations to him. But for a lot of rock and roll stars, it doesn't work out that way. When we come back, we'll open up the phone lines and take some of your questions from my guest, Zoe Cormier, about her book, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. Stay with us. Zoe Cormier, before the break, you were telling me the story about Rat Park. Please continue. Hello?
Sure. Yes, hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Great. So Rat Park was a scientific experiment conducted by a scientist named Bruce Alexander, and this is in Vancouver. So traditional studies that had looked at rats involving cocaine involved putting a needle directly into the spine of the rat and giving them a button where they could self-administer doses of cocaine. Now, the rats were in cages and hooked up to, as I said, needles directly put into the spine. So scientists concluded from these studies that cocaine was a very tasty drug, and given the opportunity to do it over and over again, any mammal would. However, Dr. Alexander thought, well, they're in very uncomfortable circumstances. They can't play with other rats. They can't wander around. They can't have sex. So what would happen if you gave them a nice, comfortable existence? So he created something called Rat Park. So there were other rats to fornicate with. The rats could wander around. So he took cocaine-addicted rats and gave them a very nice setting in which to live. And lo and behold, they didn't want to do cocaine all the time. In fact, eating food, having sex, playing with little bits of shredded paper were more fun than getting high.
I guess there's a lesson in there. Before we go open up the phone lines, I wanted to go back to ayahuasca, because we just touched on it very briefly. You know, we've had several shows where we've had guests on, shaman even, who've told us about healing properties from ayahuasca. When you think about the combination of different plants that has to come up with this, I have to wonder how the heck anybody ever discovered the combination. But healing properties, in addition, people have said that you can access other realities, other realms. I mean, they rave about its overall qualities. And yet, I guess it would be illegal here, even though there's a great deal of ayahuasca tourism. What's your take on ayahuasca and what its possibilities are, its promise? Or do you?
I haven't done it myself, so I can't speak from first-hand experience. It's a very interesting drug because DMT is the only hallucinogen that is made by the human body. Pretty much every other drug comes from a mushroom or a plant or a lab. Ayahuasca is actually made, DMT is actually made in the human body. It is made by every living organism on Earth. It's made by grass. It's made by grasshoppers. It's made by hippos. It's made by hippies. Every creature makes DMT in its own body. So it's the only, quote unquote, endemic hallucinogen. As to the ayahuasca, the people who are quite religious about it, I don't know. I'm not quite sure what to say about them. They can be very evangelical.
Yeah, they're passionate defenders about it, that's for sure. Let's try to take a couple of calls. Bill, I'm sorry, go ahead.
They're just passionate to a point of, you know, they're very zealous.
Let's take a call or two. Bill in Decatur, Illinois. Hi, Bill. You're on with Zoe. What's on your mind?
Yes. Hello, friends. Yes, interesting show tonight. I'm a fairly new listener, but I was just thinking about the basic symbiotic triune aspect of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and how they are synergistic, essentially, and the evolution of music in itself, you know, beginning with the tribal ritualistic aspect of the drum beat, and how and what emotions that raises innately, to the, you know, classical period and the music that was produced there, and now in the electronic age with the evolution there. And some of my favorite music is the ambient music, the binaural beats, the harmonic frequencies that put people in certain frequencies in, you know, the alpha, beta, theta wavelengths. And, you know, considering that the rhythm of the heartbeat is, if I'm correct, isn't it identical to the circadian rhythm of the earth? And, you know, the newfound theory, scientific theories and string theory, which postulates that everything is, you know, held together by certain frequencies harmonically. And so I'm wondering, given that sex is the most potent force in the known physical universe, coinciding with, you know, music and how that, you know, puts us in these certain moods. And with drugs, you know, you've been talking about DMT and the certain hallucinogens that I've experimented somewhat with, and it's basically what music looks like, in a sense. You understand? So I'm wondering if the evolution of music, I don't know if the guest touches upon this at all in her book, but if this is a mode of evolution that we are striving towards, perhaps unconsciously, innately, with the three aspects that the, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll represent.
Well, that's a lot to chew on. Zoe, you want to take a stab at it?
I would. So what's a single question?
Well, how about this? How about we try this? Is there a role that music has played in human evolution?
Yes, I would say very much so. Music has been integral to coordinated efforts. So we would never have built the pyramids. We would never have put up the statues of Easter Island. We never would have been able to coordinate our efforts to make any kind of form of monumental architecture if it wasn't for music and the fact that we can go heave ho in time together.
There was a point you made in the book that I had never read before, is that you said that those early cave paintings, maybe Altamira or something like that, occurred at a special place in the cave. Yeah.
Mm.
What was the point you're making about the location of where the paintings are in the cave? I guess there were sound qualities at that point that made it interesting.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite stories from the study of music and history. So it turns out that a lot of the cave paintings in France, for example, they were created in the location in the cave that had the best acoustics. So today we go, chug, chug, mic check. And they were doing the exact same thing 50,000 years ago. That was where they were putting the paintings, where they had the biggest sonic boom.
So you theorize that maybe chanting or sounds were part of the creation process while the paintings were going on? Or what was happening there?
Huh. I mean, your guess is as good as mine. It's some kind of combination of artistry and musicality.
That was rock and roll of the Stone Age or something. Huh. We're going to Rick in McAllen, Texas. Hi, Rick. You're on with Zoe. What's on your mind?
Oh, my question to Zoe is whether some of the popular drugs from the 70s Has there been a study whether they have an effect on anti-aging, like with the Rolling Stones or the Aerosmith, that seem like they're going to go forever?
Huh. I haven't seen any scientific studies that looked at that. However, I guess I can just repeat what was said earlier, which is that the guy who invented LSD lived to be 102.
Good question, though, Rick. Thanks. Roy in Summerfield, North.
I think, you know what? I would actually say that stress alleviation is the most important thing any drug can do.
Well, it is amazing that these people who, they were the wildest partiers in the world, and here they are still going strong. Keith Richards, how is it impossible that he's even alive? And yet still, he survived all that stuff, still doing, cranking out great music.
Mm.
No theory, huh? Okay. We're going to go to Roy in Summerfield, North Carolina. Roy, you're on with Zoe Cormier.
Thank you. Zoe, are you aware that Aldous Huxley, is that who you were talking about earlier, first acid trip?
No, she was talking about Hoffman.
No, that would be Albert Hoffman.
Oh, Albert Hoffman. Okay, right. Okay, well, that's just a funny thing that Aldous Huxley, you know, he wrote all those Doors of Perception, and he took a lot of LSD.
Yeah, this is a beautiful book.
Yeah, he died on the same day that John Kennedy died, 11/22/63, and so did C.S. Lewis. And I'd like to hear your opinion, if you give it any credibility. Mary Pinchot Meyer, who was a mistress of John Kennedy's a little bit at the end there, ex-wife of Cord Meyer, who was in the CIA, who really used a lot of LSD in the 50s. Well, Mary Pinchot Meyer, in a book called Mary's Mosaic by Peter Janney, who was a friend of the family, says that Mary brought LSD and pot to the White House in like 63, maybe early 62, and JFK probably took a trip, probably smoked pot a few times. Have you heard that anywhere else? She knew Timothy Leary too. Mary Pinchot Meyer did, knew him well, and she thought this would be like a peace spreading thing if she could get it to certain heads of the government. You ever heard anything about that?
No, I'm afraid I haven't.
Sorry, Roy, couldn't help you there. A lot of famous people, though, Chloe, a lot of famous people, great minds, were druggies. I mean, we've mentioned Aldous Huxley, and we touched on Steve Jobs earlier. I briefly mentioned the hippies who saved physics. Those brilliant minds are still around. Jack Sarfati, Fred Allen Wolf, who re-energized interest in quantum mechanics, quantum physics. Sigmund Freud, all these people did at least some of them did their share of drugs, and there were positive results associated with their work, right?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. I mean, Confessions of an Opium Eater is one of the most boring pieces of literature ever written.
And who wrote that?
That would be... sorry, the name fails me. Thomas Quincy.
Okay. Are there any important discoveries that you think scientists would not have found if they weren't going after trying to figure out our hedonistic impulses?
Any discoveries that wouldn't have been made?
Yeah. You know, things that they were looking for, they were looking into something and they discovered something great because they were studying hedonism. Is there any that pop up that you can think of?
I would say the discovery of neurotransmitters. So we found the chemical messengers in the mind because we do drugs. And this is not a conspiracy theory. This is absolute truth. The reason being that in the Victorian era, right, so in the 1800s, scientists were quite puzzled by the fact that molecules made by plants or mushrooms or in a lab could make an effect in the brain. And the reason that a chemical made by the coffee plant or the tea plant or the ergot fungus, which is related to LSD, the reason those molecules can affect a change in the brain is because they mimic our natural neurotransmitters. So they are masquerades. So, for example, psilocybin behaves like serotonin. LSD behaves like serotonin. Caffeine behaves like what's called ATP, adenosine triphosphate, which is the molecular currency of energy. And scientists mapped drugs before they mapped the neurotransmitters. The very first time that this happened, nicotine was isolated in 1843, and it wasn't until the 1970s that the receptor, which normally binds to acetylcholine, was discovered. And they called the receptor the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor. Right, so that's more than 100 years. Again, so the pattern continues. They mapped cannabis in 1964, and they found the endocannabinoid that it mimics in 1990, and they named our own body part after a drug. Morphine, 1805. Endorphins, 1975.
That's some big ones. Those are some big discoveries. And nitrous oxide, massive. You mentioned. Yeah, laughing gas, nitrous oxide. You have a section about that in the book. And when they were experimenting mm-hmm. with this stuff, they had no idea about its applications and how it would change medicine, but it did.
Precisely. It led to pain-free surgery. How many people listening right now have had pain-free surgery or were born to someone who had pain-free surgery? I'm sure pretty much almost everyone.
Yeah, how many teeth have been pulled on with a nitrous?
Precisely.
So, other plans for the book? You're going to go on a tour. Is it going to become a TV show? There's a lot of really interesting stuff in it.
That remains to be determined. But
Guerrilla Science.
I'm just overjoyed to have made it in the first place, to be honest.
Guerrilla Science is such a great idea about a way to bring science to the masses, to make it interesting to places like music festivals and events. Any plans to expand that to the U.S. or anything like it?
Yes, there is an American branch. If you Google Guerrilla Science and if you look up the Intergalactic Travel Bureau, you'll see that the American branch of Guerrilla Science has been doing quite a lot.
And is that the name of the American branch, Intergalactic Travel Bureau?
No, Guerrilla Science.
Okay. Anything else to say about the mix of sex, drugs, and rock and roll? How intertwined they are? Is that that's a combination that sort of naturally goes together?
I think I would just quote my mom, who I always quote when I give public talk. She has been a wonderful, wonderful form of support, and she summed up 3 years of research in one sentence. Most fun things in life are bad for you, but nothing will kill you faster than having no fun at all.
Well, those are words to live by. And I mean, have you sort of followed that? Okay. Well, thank you. Zoe, best of luck with the book. It was a really interesting read, that's for sure. And thank you for being on the program. Coming up, The Grateful Dead, The Life and Times of the Grateful Dead with David Brown. And we'll be opening up the phone lines later in the program so all you deadheads can call in. Stay with us. Jimi Hendrix takes us into the break.